Seder Nezikin. So first of all, with Seder Nezikin, you open first and foremost with Baba Kama. Baba Kama opens up with the famous discussion of Arba Avos Nezikin, right? The four Avos Nezikin. So let's talk about that, right? The Torah prohibits, for example, in general, halacha outlines certain parameters of a particular halacha, whether it's a mitzvah or whether it's an iser. And if that the principal criteria has been met, then the mitzvah has been performed or the iser is violated. So for example, eating pig, once a person has eaten a certain amount, the criteria has been violated and they have violated the iser. That's it. The criteria has been met. They violated the iser. And provided those basic conditions exist, little else is going to influence or define the act or the event itself. Give another good example, clear example. Torah prohibits eating nevela, right? Meat that's not kosher because it was not slaughtered correctly or the animal was sick. Now, by taking the word achila in the Torah, it dictates that the formal act of eating is required in order to violate the deraisa. The formal act of eating is required in order to violate the deraisa. One who derives pleasure but does not eat has not violated the iser. The iser is achila. That's what it says. You shouldn't eat an avela. Now, once the formal condition of achila, of eating, is in place, everything else is of little importance. That's it. There's no middle ground. In order to violate X, you have to do A. If you don't have A, you have nothing. If you do have A, what else is relevant to us? But the beginning of Baba Kama provides a very interesting, different categorical structure. Provides a different categorical structure. And, for example, we're introduced in the opening Mishnah to Arba Avos, four Avos, four prototypes of damages where a person is going to be liable. So why is Niske Mamon, monetary damages, divided into four distinct categories? And how does that help us in any way? Why do I need that? Why is it divided in that way? And the Gemara starts with a comment where it says, Avos michlal de'ika toldos. From the fact there are Avos, primary categories, father categories, I could infer that there are secondary categories. So for example, the Torah describes an Av Malacha of Karen, right? An animal which, you know, violently and maliciously gores another animal with its horn. Goring with its horns. It's mentioned explicitly in the Torah. It's Shmos Perakav Alv Pasakav Ches. That's an Av Malacha. Now, if an animal violently and intentionally damages with another part of its body, it constitutes a Tolada, a derivative of Karen, a spin-off. So what does that help us to know that there's Avos and Toldos? What ramification do we have? What difference does it make? Meaning, if you eat nevela, we don't say there's a primary category nevela and then there's a second. No, there just is nevela. So how are we supposed to understand this Av and Tolda phenomena in the case of Nezikin? What is this relationship? So the logical point of departure to begin this conversation would be to think about other areas of halacha where there is a Av and Tolda relationship. The most immediate example that probably comes to your mind is the area of Shabbos. Shabbos has a sort of relationship of Avos and Tolda. That's for sure a common one. By the way, the Gemara has it by a similar hierarchy when it comes to Tumah as well, when it comes to impurity in the case of Tumah. But that could be a non-literal extension. So I'm going to put Tumah aside for now because that's the easiest one to lay aside. Another possible instance of Toldot, the Gemara has in Sanhedrin 62a, where the Gemara talks about Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara relates to the prohibition of perverting the Avodas HaMikdash, of corrupting the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash for Avodah Zarah. So let's say you sacrifice, let's say you sprinkle blood, let's say you burn an animal in the worship of Avodah Zarah, you're violating the Isser of Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says, but if you break a stick, Shviras Makel, you violate the Tolda of Shchitas Avodah Zarah. Now, although he hasn't exactly sacrificed an animal, he's performed an action which resembles the sacrifice and thereby violating a Tolada of Avodah Zarah. I'll give you another example. Moed Katan. The Gemara right at the beginning, 2b, talks about the Isser of farming during Shemitah every seventh year. You have to let the land lie fallow. And the Gemara questions why the Torah specifically enumerates pruning, the prohibition to prune trees. Right? If pruning is a form of planting. Planting is forbidden. Right? So why did the Torah specify the prohibition of collecting grapes, bitzira, when it's a form of ketzira, harvesting? Why do I need that? Wouldn't we have figured it out? So the Gemara says, because it wanted to show us that those are toladas, derivatives. Right? So here we have again this idea of avos and toldas. We have it by Shabbos, we have it by Shemitah, we have it by Avodah Zarah, and we have it by Niske Momon, our case, Bava Kama, by damages. Why do these categories allow a tolada extrapolation, while other Isurim resist an expansion in that nature? So one approach to justifying the production of toladas in these areas is to locate a common denominator in each of them. So listen to this. This is the svar I want to share with you. In general, a violation of an iser is forbidden only because Hashem commanded it that way. And therefore, the action which is wrong is because Hashem said it was wrong. It's an assault, you know, meaning any subsequent action that you did was banned because Hashem said not to do it. The action is forbidden in an absolute and self-defined manner. God said not to do it, that's it. That's all you need. Just don't do that action. God said not to do it, that's it. But Shabbos, by contrast, Shabbos is not just a forbidden maisa. It's also an attack on the overarching kedusha of Shabbos and Am Yisrael. Right? The whole kedusha that permeates the seventh day has a definite halachic impact too. Meaning violation of Shabbos changes your category. Someone who willingly violates Shabbos and grew up religious, such a person is labeled as a Nachri. They're labeled as a non-Jew. Right? Because your action carries with it broader implications. Meaning not only is the Maisa a problem, but the Totsah, the result, is a problem as well. Right? And since the prohibition is based partly on the consequences of the act, there's another category that goes beyond avos, and therefore it says, don't just look at the primary category in the Torah. There's going to be derivatives as well. So meaning like this. So I want to say it like this. We would justify the existence of tolados in an area of a halacha in where the general consequences actually, not just the inherent act, but they comprise part of the prohibition as well. Think about Avodah Zarah. That makes sense by Avodah Zarah. Your act of Avodah Zarah isn't just violating Isser X or Y. What you have done is an attack on Malchut Shamayim by worshipping Avodah Zarah. And therefore, anything which is a derivative is a consequence of that, even though it's not the stated Isser in the Torah. It's a derivative. Therefore, the toldos are included, Torah is included as well. Shemitah, we know Shemitah is connected to Shabbos. It's Shabbos of the land. And that's the same idea. But now we come to our case and we close this part of the shiur. Wait a second, but what about Niske Momon? But what about torts? What about damages? Right? Should we really attach any significance to damage beyond just, okay, you damage, you make it right? So it could be that what we're learning is that, and this is why Nezikin is so critical, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by placing Toladas in Shemitah, Shabbos, and what else? Shemitah, Shabbos, Avodah Zarah, and Niske Momon, it's telling us an assault on another person or on their stuffs. That is an assault on Malchus Shemayim because you're attacking the Kavod Abrius, the dignity of another human being. You're attacking people who are created B'Tselem Elokim. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers Niske Momon also in this extended area of halacha that are not just avos, but they're also told us. Okay, that's the first ha'ara I wanted to give you on the sugya of avos nezikin. Next, new topic. If you missed me, second topic. Here we go. The first rule of monetary litigation, dine momenus, holds the following. Hamotzi mechavero alav haraya. That one who wants to take something from someone else, meaning you want to say that belongs to you, well, then this gets us to the beginning of the second set of Mishnayos after Bava Kama. This gets us to Bava Metzia, right? Hamotzi mechavero lavaraya. One who wants to extract must bring a proof. They have the burden of proof. The burden of proof is upon the person trying to extract. They shoulder the burden of proof. The accused, who physically possesses the disputed item or money, is given the overwhelming benefit of the doubt. They are given the overwhelming benefit of the doubt. And while the plaintiff has to provide powerful evidence to maintain a favorable verdict, and generally the standards are quite high. Actual witnesses, edim, or a contract, shtar, you need, are powerful enough to compel the extraction of money. But lesser forms, lesser proofs like migo, rov, karov, chazaka, they're generally not considered robust enough to be able to extract money. Now, a bunch of Gemaras have a very interesting machlokas amarayim about the efficacy of Bari and Shema. Bari and Shema, these are not two people, Bari and Shema. Rather, there's a famous categories in halacha that how would the halacha rule in a scenario where the plaintiff lodges a concrete and confident claim? The plaintiff is a Bari. I am certain the defendant has the defendant has possession. He's a Shema. He's like, I'm not sure. I think. Would we award the money to the confident litigant in the place of the unsure one who happens to be Muchsuk at the time? Now, by the way, the most elementary case of Bari and Shema is a case where Reuven confidently demands $100 from Shimon, and Shimon says he's unsure who actually owns the money. That's the classic Bari and Shema. Rav Nachman and Rav Yochanan ruled the disparity between their claims is not sufficient grounds to extract money. Bari the Shema, lav Bari Adif. Bari and Shema, lav Bari Adif. And therefore, one of the most basic and permanent fixtures of Mominus is that the Motzi, the extractor, has to furnish proof. Since in this case, he hasn't furnished any proof, he's just certain. I don't care if you're certain. Do you have proof? No, you don't have proof. And therefore, he's not going to win. But however, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda's position is fascinating. They hold Bari Veshema, Bari Adif. Bari Veshema, Bari Adif. No proof. How do we reconcile that with the concept of Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Haraya? How do we square that away? So, one possibility is that Rav Huna would view the difference between claims as a difference in what the events actually were. Meaning, generally, evidence arrives in a package called testimony. That's the usual way evidence arrives. Witnesses, shtaros, things like that. But sometimes, an internal assessment of how this shmecked, that right in the way the claims came forward, maybe that's enough of an evidence. Meaning, what we're saying is, if you hold Bari Veshema, Bari Adif, that the person who's certain, it's a good claim, one possibility of why that should work is because that's like offering actual evidence of the event itself. Meaning, you don't have literal evidence, but the way you're giving it over, that for us from the eyes of halacha is evidence, right? Quite literally, we can infer from the presentation of the claim that the Bari plaintiff is mamish telling the truth. And this indicator is sufficient to overpower the status quo. That's one pshat. In Bari Veshema, Bari is stronger. But I don't think that's the true pshat. See, if you look at the closer phraseology of Rav Huna's statement that Bari Adif, Rav Huna did not say Bari Veshema, Bari Neman. Bari versus Sheman, believe the Bari. Instead, he formulated his principle as Bari Veshema, Bari Adif. The Bari prevails. Somehow, the Bari triumphs even without evidence. Even if the evidence is inadmissible, the Bari somehow emerges as the victor. Meaning, two ways of understanding why Bari wins. One, you could claim that Bari is like an internal evidence to the veracity of his claim, and that's enough. The second way of looking at it is Bari is not evidence, but somehow the halacha has awarded the Bari the victor. This is semantical stuff, Einhorn. What are you busy with? The nafkaminas here are tremendous. The differences are huge. For example, Tosfos in several locations distinguishes between two types of Bari Veshema. If the Bari is a courageous claim, because the plaintiff has reason to anticipate some real resistance from the defendant, and the Shema is a feeble claim because we expect more reliable and more certain information from the defendant, Bari will override Shema. It says Tosfos, if the offset between the two claims is not that large, the Bari is relatively weak and the Shema is a little bit strong, then we don't say Bari Adif. Even Rav Huna will agree. So take that position of Tosfos, that Bari v'Adif doesn't always, not always the case. It depends how large the gap is. So like this, if the Pshat in Bari Adif is that the internal veracity is considered like evidence itself, this is no veracity, this is so weak, then we would understand Tosfos' distinction. But if I see it the second way, that Bari, the Torah says, wins, I don't care. It's not evidence, you're right, but Bari wins. He has a Bari. Why should there be a chilik in the quantified nature of that Bari itself? Okay, so that's that second sugya, Bari v'shema, Bari adif, that one would land upon in Ezekiel. Discussed a little bit, Hamotzi mechaveru alav haraya. Bava Basra, you talk a little bit about Dover hagorim lamaman. You get this in Bava Kama. These sugyas all cross over. They're all over. So, for example, Dover hagorim lamaman. By the way, I love, now I'm getting into this in my head. We could do this now for 4 hours, 5 hours. I love this stuff. I love Nezikin. There's so many good topics. Don't worry, Joe. We're going to end soon. I'm not going to schlep it out. But this is such good. I love Nezikin. Such good stuff in Nezikin. So, Davar HaGorim LaMoman. An item can sometimes provide monetary benefit for someone who doesn't legally own it. For example, an animal dedicated as a korban is legally owned by Hekdesh, but the person who dedicated the animal, they remain responsible to deliver the korban. I still am responsible to bring it. I got to show up with it. And failure to do that would incur for me additional charges. So the animal, although not under my legal ownership anymore, it still provides monetary benefit in the fact that I don't have to bring another korban if I get this there. Okay, so there is a value of it to me even though I don't own it. That's an interesting, you would say something only has monetary value to you if you own it. No, there are cases where you have monetary value and you don't own it. Rabbi Shimon has an interesting theory. He says, Kol hagorim lamamun kamamun dami. Items that provide benefit are considered equally equivalent to legally owned items. And therefore, meaning, if somebody steals a korban, he's halachically obligated to compensate the owner who dedicated the korban. Even though me, the owner, I'm no longer, I dedicated this to the Beis HaMikdash. If I didn't bring it to the Beis HaMikdash yet and someone stole it from me, they have to repay me. Even though the original owner is not in full legal possession. The korban is owned by Hekdesh. The original owner still receives a compensation because this is a gorim lamamun. A gorim lamamun. So here's what I want to share with you, the lumdus of this. How do we understand this concept of gorim lamamun? Do we say that a gorim lamamun is kamamun, meaning davar hagorim lamamun kimamun dami, with a kaf adimyon? The kaf creates an analogy between two items, right? Are they relatable? Meaning the known template that we have here is mamun, and the derivative is something which provides monetary interest to me, a gorim lamamun. So a strict reading of this would indicate that absolute parity, that the derivative between them is absolutely identical. A more loose reading of the text would assume that the similarity is halachic in nature, but they're not really identical. You understand? When we say davar hagorim lamamun kamamun dami, my relationship to the animal that I dedicated to Hekdesh is like my money. Is it literally like my money, or in some aspects like my money? So how do we understand it? So you first have to study, you have to know where the halachas are that it applies or not. For example, the Gemaras have cases where overcharging, ona, when you overcharge somebody, you have to pay them back, right? So the Gemara says overcharge doesn't apply to Hekdesh, to consecrated items. Well, wait a second. I thought we said davar hagorim lamamun is kamamun. There you see, it's not literal. It didn't apply across the board. It has limited application in terms of what it means that it's your money. The Yerushalmi has an example where it says that a person is allowed to intentionally let blood from a korban, which he's responsible for, even though it's usually forbidden to cause a wound to a Hekdesh animal. That ability for you to willfully cause a wound to this animal indicates that according to Reb Shimon, Davar Agorim Lamamon, Kim Mamon, you're still the owner. On some level, you are still the owner. Okay, so that's that sugya, Davar Hagorim Lamamon. This is big throughout Shas. Whenever you have something is like something, is the like literal or is it just a type of halachic analogy between the two? Another case. Maybe we'll just close with this. There's so much. We could dance all night with this stuff. The opening Mishnayos here. Let's go to Makos. Makos is another big nezik in Mishnayos. The beginning of Makos says, "Ketzad Eidim Nasim Zomim." How do Eidim become Zomim? Right? How do they? Ketzad Eina Eidim. It starts right. It should start with How do they not become Eidim Zomim? It starts with. So, because the cases it gives are cases where it does not become exactly Eidim Zomim. Again, those who don't know Eidim Zomim as follows. When you have witnesses who come and you prove that they're lying because they were with you, Imanu Hayisem, you were with us. You couldn't have possibly seen this event. We give to those witnesses what they intended to do to the guy they were testifying against. So the Mishnah records a couple cases where you can't really apply it because of technical difficulty. So the Gemara says, yeah, if the guy comes and says, you are a Ben Gerusha, O Ben Chalutza, you are a son of a divorced woman or a son of someone who had Chalitza and got married inappropriately. You can't do it back to them. You can't make them a Ben Gerusha Ben Chalutza, right? It's not going to work. Hold on. The computer here did a, remind me later, 1 second. You can't do a Ben Gerusha Ben Chalutza back to them. So instead you give them lashes, right? Classic Mishnayos. That's Makos. So now, Ben Gerusha Ben Chalutza, okay? The status of somebody being considered a Ben Gerusha. What's a Ben Gerusha? Ben Gerusha is someone who was a divorced woman who ended up marrying a Kohen. The child is a Ben Gerusha. Or if a Kohen married someone who did Chalitza, the child is a Ben Chalutza. They have a special status in Halacha. Ben Gerusha, Ben Chalutza. Okay. Right? They lose their Kohen status. So here's the problem. The concept of Ben Gerusha is Deraisa. The concept of Ben Chalutza is derabanan. Our Mishnah and Makos is talking about lashes deraisa. What is Ben Chalutza doing there? What is it doing there? By the way, if you don't believe me, the Rambam writes straight out. Rambam says Ben Chalutza is derabanan. Rambam writes it in Hilchas Yibum v'Chalitza. Ben Gerusha is deraisa. So why the Mishnah in Makos put Ben Gerusha and Ben Chalutza there? So the Ritva says Shigra Delishna. It flowed together. You go say, oh, what are you learning? Oh, what are you? Ben Gerusha, Ben Chalutza. You know, they go together. Shigra Delishna. It flows off the tongue at the same time. Good. Fine. It's incidental. But I want to suggest another pshat that doesn't rely on Shigra Delishna, because the Rambam himself, in recording the laws of Makos, does put Ben Gerusha and Ben Chalutza next to each other in terms of lashes. And again, Rambam is the one who held Ben Chalutza's Derabanan. And Rambam is not Shigra Delishna. It's not what he does. Rambam is very precise in his word choice. He's teaching us specific halachas for a reason. So I want to share the following chiddush. And this is the yesod throughout Shas, the yesod throughout Nezikin for sure. If I violate a deraisa by accident, I accidentally ate pig, so I have to do tshuva for what I did, even though it's accidental, because at the end of the day, there was something radioactive that I put into me. There was something in me that was radioactive. And therefore, I need to do tshuva for that. The question is, what if I did a derabanan by accident? What if I did a derabanan by accident? So that's a question in general. What status do derabanans have? Meaning when I know there's a piece of pig in front of me and I'm aware of it, that's a radioactive piece of meat. The meat is transformed to a chefetz shel iser. By Isuri Durabanan, I have to listen to the rabbis, but it doesn't mean the item itself is actually inherently anything wrong. The rabbis didn't want me to do it because it may lead to X, it may lead to Y. So the question is, what if you violate Nisr Durabanan by accident? Because why would it be different? Because at the end of the day, the item itself isn't intrinsically a problem. The problem is rebelling against the rabbis, but you didn't rebel, it was accidental. So maybe you don't need tshuva by an accident Durabanan. Famous position of the Gracie Uplacy. The Gracie Uplacy says that by a derabanan, you don't need to do tshuva if it's by accident. But I'm going to show you another opinion. The Yad Ramah, which is a commentary on Sanhedrin, has the following. Sanhedrin talks about the following case. It talks about that King Achav, what he did was, he had the, King Chizkiah, I forgot which king it was, He asked the rabbis, he made a second Nisan. Instead of a second Adar, he made a second Nisan. He intercalated the Nisan. He's not allowed to intercalate the Nisan. And when he realized what he did wrong, he went to go ask Mechila from the Chachamim for what he did. He asked for Mechila from the Chachamim. The Yad Ramah says that Isser is an Isser Durabanan, to do the wrong month, to do a wrong Iber, an Iber Nisan instead of an Iber Adar. That's an Isser Durabanan. Notice, he asked for forgiveness from the rabbis, but it was by accident. He didn't know. And you see, it's only Durabanan according to the Yad Ramah. So this is a famous machlokus, whether or not by Durabanan, by accident, do you need to ask for Mechila or not? What's the fight about? What? It's so semantical. This one says, yeah, this one says no. It's never semantical. No machlokus is semantical. According to those who say you need to do tshuva, they hold that the Isuri Durabanan are transferred into a Cheftza Deraisa by virtue of the fact that the rabbis say it's Usser. By the fact that the rabbis say something is Usser, that Durabanan is transferred into a Cheftza Shel Isser. Those who say that, no, you don't have to do tshuva on an accidental Durabanan, they don't hold the thing becomes transferred when the rabbi says it's Usser. You have to listen to the rabbis. But the thing doesn't become transferred. The Cheftza still says a Cheftza Shel Heter. So that's what the Rambam is telling us here. That's what our Mishnah is teaching us. Yasa zev ben gerusha ben chalutza, that a ben chalutza, even though maybe technically a durabanan, but it is transformed into a cheftza shel iser by virtue of the fact that it's forbidden, and therefore makos deraisa are going to be applicable in such a case. And therefore the Rambam is telling you, ben gerusha ben chalutza, not shigra delishna, it rolls off the tongue. They both deserve makos. They both deserve makos deraisa. How could ben chalutza have makos deraisa? Because for the Rabbanan, for Rambam, every Rabbanan becomes on some level transformed to a level of a deraisa itself.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Yeah, but maybe
excellent. You would say that's the Yad Ramah is not a raya. You're trying to say the Yad Ramah is not a raya that you need tshuva by Durabanan. That's not that over there. That was different. That was not about Durabanan deraisa. There was because it was a public going against the rabbis, even if it was by accident. Right. But since it was Farhesia, that itself needed its own level of tshuva. But in general, Durabanan don't need tshuva. That would be good. But the Rambam is paskening like Therefore, the Rambam.
No, but maybe when it comes to when you do chalitza. Because it affects
it's a more public aspect
than yourself. It has a public aspect too.
Excellent. Right. So there's another chiluk, another category. You don't need tshuva by a durabanan by accident, but when the durabanan is going to affect and impinge upon other people's lives and have some element of farhesia to it, then maybe by there we do have an aspect of tshuva. It's a great chap.
But that means every rabbanan, every avira that you made that's a rabbanan avira,